We begin this the middle portion of the book of Job tonight. It's 35 chapters long. It's repetitious. One of the reasons that it is, it's very flowery. It even seems excessive in its phrasing, but it's typical of Hebrew poetry. It's a true story. It's history. There's a lot of things that we can learn from it, but it is written in the style of poetry. And we begin tonight in chapter 3 hearing the first words that Job has to actually recorded since all of this grief has happened to him, where he actually expresses his grief. And it's not pretty. But then grief isn't. Grief needs to be expressed. That's part of the healing process. And there are three things I want you to notice as we look through this first. It's just a bleh. It's just Job venting his grief. Three things I want you to know. He's not speaking in character, and he's not even speaking rationally in what he says. It's a real mistake to create doctrine from Job chapter 3, because in Job chapter 6, when he's defending himself against the accusations of the first one of his friends that confronts him, in the very first verse of chapter 6, he says, "Look, I just wish you understood my grief. I know I'm talking wildly and rashly, but it's the grief talking." So take that into consideration. So Job himself says he's not being really rational. So it's good that you note that. The second thing that I want you to note about this next two chapters, well, no, it's one chapter, is that God doesn't hold it against him in the end. In fact, God upholds what Job says about God's involvement in this whole deal. And God is the one who says that Job's friends, who are absolutely convinced that Job is filled with pride, that all of his problems are because God is angry at him because of some hidden sin. And the more that they accuse him of it and the more he defends himself, the madder they get. And it's good to flip over to when God enters the scene, the very last thing that God addresses with Job's friends. In fact, he calls the guy by name that we're going to see in chapter 4 and 5, a man named Eliphaz, and he says, "You know, you're wrong. Everything that you said about me, every way that you tried to apply your wisdom about me to Job's situation, wrong, 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 wrong." And then God says, "In fact, all three of you guys are wrong. I'll tell you what, I'll forgive you if you ask Job to pray for you." I just something about that just I really like. God says, "You know, I'll forgive you, but you've got to ask him if he'll pray for you, because I listen to him." So here's Job venting, and God just doesn't seem to hold it against him. He understands. Can I just tell you one little bit of wisdom? I wish that I invented it. I didn't. I heard it from somebody else, but it stood me in good stead. And it is the fact that we judge other people by their actions, but we judge ourselves by our intentions. And that's wrong. We may do the very same thing that somebody else does, and but we say, "Well, yeah, I know I did this, or I know I said that, but what I really meant, or what I really intended." And then somebody does the very same thing, and we just react to what they've done, and we just cut them off at the knees. And that's just the wrong way to be. And Job's friends would have done a good job if they had just kept their mouths shut and just been there to comfort him. But when they felt like they had to tell him, give him a piece of their mind, tell him what they really thought, they just made a bad situation worse. So the third thing that we want to keep in mind is that through all of the, we're going to see Job cursing eloquently the day that he was born, wishing he was dead. I don't know if you've ever been so discouraged or so beat up in your life that you wish you were dead? I have. I was at a place that was so bad in my life that I prayed for God to kill me. I'm glad he didn't, although I know I would have been in heaven, but I understand this man's cry, and I wasn't going through anything as hard as what he is going through. But in all of that, he never cursed God. He never disowned God, and he really never abandoned his faith. He kept his view of God. He did not understand why any of this was happening. He didn't have chapter 1 and chapter 2 to understand the heavenly scene. It all is just dumped on him. But he never abandoned his trust in God, and he never disowned God, and he never cursed God, even when he didn't understand. It is a major step forward in my maturity as a believer when I will trust God even when he doesn't explain himself. And it's interesting that Job cries out for all kinds of things in the next 35 chapters, but when it got right to the end, God really didn't explain himself. He just said, Job's right and you guys are wrong. And their primary line was, you know, God's mad at you because you've sinned. And God says, no, he hasn't. And no, I'm not. And Job was vindicated, and apparently he didn't need an explanation. Another thing that I mentioned last week that's really good to keep in mind, as horrible as the suffering was, all suffering for a believer, for a godly person, all suffering is temporary. All of it. If God never fixed the things that are breaking my heart right now, if he never fixed them till the day I die, if he never changed my circumstances to where it was pleasant, if it was always difficult until the day I die, that's still temporary. Because for the next couple of billion years, the good that God has done in my life through the suffering is going to be part of my character, and it's going to affect the way that I enjoy bliss for billions and billions of years. So if you weigh it that way, now even on an earthly scale, remember last week we looked at the fact that Job raised 10 kids with living a godly life, being actually greatly blessed by God, so that he was the most prosperous person in the entire part, that whole part of the world. And he lost everything in a space of 5 minutes. And then however long it took for Satan to unload on Job's body. But all of the 35 chapters that we're beginning tonight of the middle of this debate from Job's friends that got more and more angry at him, that could have taken place in one day. It's just a long discourse, and everybody keeps, Job is kind of surrounded by people, and he's trying to defend himself, but that didn't cover a long period of time. And in the end, when God restored all of Job's fortunes and blessed him once again, it says, after that happened, Job lived 140 years and saw his children and his grandchildren to the fourth generation and died at a full ripe age, blessed by God. So here's Job's life. Fabulous beginning, 10 times as long, fabulous end, a few weeks of suffering in the middle. All of a sudden, as horrible as the suffering is, it gives you different perspective. And I think all of that is important to keep in mind. I told you last week, I'm going to start reading at chapter 2, verse 11, because that's where the three friends come in. They mean well. I read a book one time called Well-Intentioned Dragons. It was an interesting book. I recommend it to ministers. You'll read, after a while when you read it, you realize this guy's hurt. He's been hurt by people, and there's just a tiny bit of bitterness. And if you can get past that, he says some really true things. He says that church people are famous for hurting other church people, and sometimes they don't mean to. They just speak when they should shut up. They talk about stuff they don't know what they're talking about. they supposedly see visions and hear things from God, and it's not from God. And the people they unload on get hurt. And he says, you know, if you can understand that that's part of the job, then you'll be prepared and it won't blow you away. And that's what I always think of when I think of these middle chapters. But I gave you three things that these guys did that were good, because we're going to talk about a lot of stuff that they did that was bad. Because even when they tell the truth, they're misapplying it. They're not telling the whole truth. Even when they claim to be giving godly advice, it does not godly advice because it doesn't apply to Job. Here's the three things they did right. Number one, they came to him. When they got the news, they traveled. And if you look on a map where they're from, they came from actually quite a distance to be there with him. The second right thing that they did is they sat in silence with him at least for 7 days and 7 nights. And that's something. You see your friend suffering and you just keep your mouth shut. Unfortunately, while they were sitting there silently, they were thinking. They were analyzing. They were thinking of what they were going to say. And they should have probably just kept their mouth shut and just stayed there. But at least they did come and they sat in silence. Here's a little saying that I got from somebody that I think is very useful. Silent sympathy provides an opportunity for the expression of grief. Silent sympathy provides an opportunity for the expression of grief. Christians are not real good at this. We feel like we have to talk. And often when we're talking, the person that's grieving doesn't have a chance to say anything and express anything, or sometimes when they do, they get piled on. But just silent sympathy, just being there and empathizing with the pain, gives the person then an opportunity. And that's what we're going to see in chapter 3. Job finally has an opportunity, and like I said, when he begins to hurl, it's not pretty. And even later, he says, yeah, you know, I know I was wild, but man, it was the grief talking. But at least he had an opportunity and the third thing they did good was they talked with him, not about him. Because it can be so destructive when if they said the things that they said to Job's face, which was bad enough, but they've said it behind his back, they would have destroyed him and his reputation, and God would have been smeared. And at least they talked to him face to face. So I'm going to begin reading there at verse 11, chapter 2. Now when Job's, we're going to do three chapters tonight, by the way, and we'll bite off probably three or four chapters next week. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place. Eliphaz, the Temanite, Bildad, the Shuhite, and Zophar, the Naamathite. I don't want to say anything about the New York Jets and Joe Namath. I don't know why, it just reminded me of it. For they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. The indication is that they were good friends. And they made an agreement with each other, said, okay, let's just meet and let's go and hang out with Job. And when they raised their eyes from afar and they didn't recognize him, they lifted their voices and they wept. It's a strong word in Hebrew. It's a word for wailing. In weeping. It's just extreme grief. Here they see their friend and they don't even recognize him. Remember last week we talked about the shape his body was in. His face was deformed. He had boils everywhere. And they saw how bad it was. And they just wept. And each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven, which was an expression of grief in that part of the world. And so they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him because they saw that his grief was very great. That's pretty much the best thing they did. If it had stayed that way, of course, here's the advantage of them giving all of their bad counsel. We have a tutorial in how not to counsel our brothers and sisters who are in suffering. And you wish more people paid attention to it because, you know, this is the oldest book in the Bible, and I'm kind of shocked that Christian people still say these same bogus things. They still do. It's like we haven't learned. So we have an opportunity to see how a godly man struggles with suffering he doesn't understand. We have an opportunity to see how not to deal with another person's suffering. Christians can be so flippant. That's because you're not the one with boils. You're not the one suffering. So it's really easy to tell somebody else how they ought to be doing it. So we can learn. And we shall if I ever get going and begin reading. After this, Job opened his mouth and he cursed the day of his birth. Remember, this is Hebrew poetry. It's repetitive. It's excessive. Hebrew poetry isn't rhythm and rhyme the way Western poetry is. Hebrew poetry is expressed with parallel phrases and thoughts and ideas, or contrasting phrases and thoughts and ideas, and sometimes in groups of seven, as we're going to see in Eliphaz's speech later. So here Job begins to rash words out of by his own admission in chapter 6. Chapter 3, verse 3, "May the day perish on which I was born, and the night in which it was said a male child is conceived. May that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor the light shine upon it. May darkness and the shadow of death claim it. May a cloud settle on it. May the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, may darkness seize it." Yeah, Job, we get it. "May it not rejoice among the days of the year. May it not come into the number of the months. Oh, may that night be barren. May no joyful shout come into it. May those who curse it, who curse the day, those who are ready to arouse Leviathan." I read one commentary on this that says he's talking about, find me some really good cursers. Get a bunch of sailors. Sailors, they're good at cursing. Get them, have them curse the day that I was born. I don't know what's... He says some kind of silly things. I don't know if you've ever been so filled with grief that you've thought about the stuff you said later and you thought, what was I thinking? Well, that's where he's at. "May the stars of its morning be dark. May it look for light, but have none, and not see the dawning of the day, because it did not shut up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide sorrow from my eyes." So after 7 days of his friends sitting silently, Job just blurts. He's going to talk about death over the next 8 or 9 verses. It's interesting that there are a couple of cult groups and the Seventh-day Adventists who, personally, I don't think I would call them a cult in the same sense that the Jehovah's Witnesses would be a cult, but there are several groups that use something that Job says here in this, in Job talking about death, and they've built a doctrine around it. And the unfortunate thing is that later, when God confronts Job in chapter 38, he says, "Job, you don't know what you're talking about. You have no idea what you're talking about when you talk about death. Have you ever stepped over the other side? Do you actually know from experience what happens after you die?" He said, "These are words without knowledge." And so keep that in mind as we look through what he says in verses 11 through, well, all the way down to verse 23 or 24. He just feels like he wants to be dead. I don't know if you've ever been there. I have been there at one time in my life. All I could think about for weeks was that the world would be better off if I was dead. God would be better off if I was dead. I would be better off if I was dead. And it was a horrible downward spiral, and I can't even believe that I'm not that same person. but I know these sentiments.